all the time. I'm used to it. They'll get over it.
Exactly. I'd like to call the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services to order. And today is Wednesday, February 19th, 03. I'd like to call the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families before us today. And before you begin, we'd like to ask Ms. Baker to give us the orientation and background today.
Good afternoon, members of the subcommittee. We are starting into the program area pieces of the Department of Human Services budget. The first one that's starting today is Children, Adults, and Families. We have about 5 days that we will expect to spend here, including a day of public testimony. I do want to let you know, however, that next week the Human Services Subcommittee will not be meeting. There are some alternative committees that are expected to meet on the 2001-03 budget issues. But we will start with Children, Adults, and Families today and tomorrow. We expect not to meet next week, and then we'll come back to them after that. So you'll be able, if you have questions, to develop those, and the agency will have plenty of time to formulate their responses. So in front of you today, as we get into the Children, Adults, and Families budget, you have another copy of the memo that was directed to your offices yesterday afternoon from our office on the orientation and background information. I'll walk through that in a minute. You have the binder that has the agency's presentation information, and this particular binder is doing double duty both for the Children and Adults and Families Program Unit. That information is in the front of it, and then when we get into Community Human Services, which is the staffing piece, that is also in this same binder. And then you have another handout on the governor's budget from the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division, and Pam Teschner will go through that. Hopefully today we will get to that. The format of the individual agency or the individual program area discussions is orientation background information from the LFO analyst, then a program area overview, then the summary of the governor's budget by budget and management, and then we'll get into more detailed program discussions. So the self-sufficiency programs, the child welfare programs, we'll discuss in more detail in the subsequent days. And then, as I think I indicated, we do expect to have at least one hearing spent on public testimony on this budget. So if I can get you to look at the memorandum from me that talks about orientation and background information. Again, this is just a very high level summary to whet your appetite for further discussions on the agency.
Let me add to that, Ms. Baker, and this is for you, Benjamin. I have been to the dentist, and I don't want any stuff out of you today. We'll call it Ms. Baker.
Low tolerance levels today. Okay. In terms of agency role, budget size, revenue sources, et cetera.
Can you define stuff, please?
I'm sorry, Ms. Baker. See, that's the kind of person he is. We have to keep him under control.
Yes, we do.
Attached to the cover memo, there's a summary of the program funding and policy for policy areas of policy support that Children, Adults, and Families address.
I want some of that stuff.
We even got the doctor joining him today.
So this program area deals with self-sufficiency programs as a conceptual program piece, and then child welfare programs for the most part. I would note that because of the reorganization, and as you heard from Jean yesterday, there has been a separation of the field staff budget from these policy and program offices. So you won't see the field staff that's related to delivering these programs through the local communities. That is not in this budget. This is the program dollars, if you will, and then the policy support pieces.
So, Ms. Becker, you're saying that if there are any questions in terms of the individual programs that guide, that the dollars guide, that we will come back to that when probably Ms. Foley and others make their presentations.
Yes, Madam Chair, if there's questions about staffing for example, the food stamps eligibility, that's part of the Community Human Services discussion. And I think, as Jean talked about yesterday, Ramona Foley is in charge of both now, that staffing piece as well as this program and policy piece. So we'll get some integrated information there. But those questions are a part of that Community Human Services budget. The next page is a chart that just shows the distribution of funding. Altogether, this is about a $1.5 billion total fund budget. $1,532 million. The biggest piece of it is self-sufficiency, and the biggest piece of that is food stamps. And food stamps are delivered as a non-limited budget item because the food stamp benefits themselves are 100% federally funded, and they're considered to be an entitlement program. If you meet the eligibility, you get the food stamps. The other pieces of the budget are shown there just so you can get a sense of the relative size of each. Again, this does not include the staffing for service delivery, so some of those pieces, of course, would be much larger once you factor that in.
And this is total funds?
These are total funds, that's correct. The next chart shows the overall funding structure for the 2305 governor's budget. You can see there federal funds are the bulk of the expenditures in this area, or the major funding source. There's only about 14% general fund in this budget. Again, the federal funds non-limited, the food stamp dollars, make up almost half the budget. But even aside from that money, the program is still heavily federal funded. And the next page shows where those federal funds come from. In addition to the food stamps, the major sources are the temporary assistance to needy families, which is a block grant, capped block grant to the states, child care and development block grant, which again is a capped block grant. It comes to Employment Department, and some of it is allocated to the Department of Human Services for these programs. Foster care and adoption assistance is a matched program similar to Medicaid, where for eligible persons and eligible expenditures, the state spends about 40 cents on the dollar, and the federal government reimburses about 60 cents on the dollar for those costs. Social services block grant is another capped federal funding stream. It's pretty flexible in terms of what it can be used for. Traditionally, the state has used it predominantly for child welfare and self-sufficiency kinds of programs. Then Medicaid, again, is not capped per se, but there is a state match requirement on that. Again, about 40 cents state dollar, 60 cents federal dollar. And then the Child Welfare Services is another federal funding source, a much smaller piece and more targeted funding for child welfare programs.
Yeah, in the block grant program, when these people come before us, they can tell us what these dollars are being used for.
Yes, Madam Chair, they can talk about that. There's also a more detail in my analysis, my written analysis that's attached to this. I didn't want to go into that level of detail in the overview, okay. But it is there, right. And the agency can respond to that. And on my sheet here where I say limited federal funds, it's limited in the sense of budget limitation. Some of these, as I've noted, are capped and are limited in that sense as well. The Medicaid money, for example, is not limited in the same sense of being a cap grant, but it's limited to the amount that you put up general fund to match those expenditures. But the limited reference is in terms of budget limitation. And then there's just a summary of budget drivers that influence this particular program area. The economic climate, certainly. As more people lose jobs or lose hours in their employment, income eligibility for cash assistance, food stamps, and child care supports increase. More people are eligible for those. In terms of job placements, if the economy is bad, it makes it more difficult to find jobs for those people who are looking for employment. It also affects the level of wages that they may be able to get on a job's placement. impact of alcohol, drug abuse, and mental illness. Many of the people that the programs are serving in this area, the people have what we term multiple barriers. That is, they may have alcohol and drug addictions. They may have mental illness. They may have no transportation or unreliable transportation. That will affect their ability to get and keep jobs. It also affects the agency's ability to help them and the cost that it takes to actually help them get into a job or retain a job. And then, of course, poverty, alcohol and drug abuse, mental illness, those factors all play as stressors that can lead to child abuse and neglect. Although, as you'll see in the information later, in terms of child abuse and neglect, the trend is favorable in terms of the number of abused and neglected children. Federal policy and funding levels are a major factor in this budget, as in many of the Department of Human Services programs. The particular one I want to highlight, underscore, put in big bold letters, is the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Reauthorization. That program is a block grant. It expired in 2002 and has been continuing along with continuing resolutions at the federal level, but there is not a definitive reauthorization at this point in terms of what the program will look like when it's reauthorized, how it will be structured, what the requirements are. And so that could have a significant impact both on the program structure and the funding requirements for those programs that we have used the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families monies for.
Madam Chair. Question to Sheila. Are we approaching, have we passed, or are we still in pretty good shape on our maintenance of efforts with regard to the TANF dollars?
The answer is maybe. Madam Chair, Representative Westland.
How about a little speech here, too? You know what I mean?
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, the state is required to provide, it's a little over $180 million, I believe, in general fund towards a maintenance of effort requirement to continue to receive the federal funding under this program. So as a state, what has been done is to look at what is the state funding that are eligible programs and services that could be designated towards that maintenance of effort requirement. For 2001-2003, before the House Bill 5100 reductions, we were, I believe, several million dollars to the good in terms of the calculation. After the House Bill 5100 reductions, I haven't seen a definitive statement of where we are yet, but part of the discussion is what expenditures do you count towards that, and are there other expenditures that we could go to that would legitimately contribute to that maintenance of effort? And so that's the reason for the maybe answer. I would say, though, that we are in probably in no way much in excess of where we need to be for maintenance of effort. And it is a concern as we're looking at both 01, 03, and then again in 03, 05.
Follow up, too. I mean, to summarize that, we were approaching it pre-5100. 5100 cuts being implemented, we may have crossed over that line based on the program, the general fund that we had put in, programs that we were identifying as maintenance of effort qualify, but there may be other programs where we're spending general fund that could also qualify that we have not identified for the federal government.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, yes, I think that summarizes it. Now, the agency may have some updated information. They're continuing to work on that, and as we, you know, move forward into the budget discussion, we will need to get some updated information on that.
Yeah, because that's a...
But that's a summary of where I think we are now.
That's a serious issue.
So with the $200 million, are you saying that we don't have to have the fear that we could have gone during this whole maintenance of effort activity, that we've not gone beyond, so that the state won't be owing money back?
Madam Chair, that's what we need to determine, both to look at what's happened in the programs that we have been that we have been acknowledging it towards the maintenance of effort, both to look at what's happened with those dollar-wise and then to look at are there other programs. So I can't say definitively today we are or are not within the maintenance of effort. But it is a biennium calculation. I mean, it's not a on a particular day are you here. It's looked at over the period of time, correct.
And I don't think we're alone in this. Yeah. I mean, a lot of other states would be approaching or have crossed over that line.
And Madam Chair and Representative Westland, perhaps as some additional background for the committee, we have in this state, as the TANF caseloads have dropped, we have used those monies for some program enhancements and to take general fund out, in effect, of some other programs. So we've used TANF money to fund programs that were previously general funded, and we've reduced our general fund expenditures in those programs. So we have done some fund shifts as the caseloads have dropped down, and that's why we're now at the level that the maintenance of effort becomes a more critical right. discussion.
Further questions?
Okay, the other bullet under federal policies and funding level relates to the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and that's in the child welfare programs. Federal legislation set some very strict constraints on what amount of time children could remain in care before there needed to be action towards permanent placements for those, and in terms of what kinds of services are provided when, both in the child welfare system and in the judicial system. And so those have been cost drivers in this budget over the last couple of biennium. Then the last bullet on this page, litigation or threat thereof. For this particular program area, the pertinent piece of legal settlement is with the Child Welfare System of Care Agreement. And this was an agreement that was entered into in 1995. We were to roll out this individualized, what they call strengths needs-based approach to children and family services. That was to be rolled out statewide by the end of this biennium under the agreement. And the issue here is what is the appropriate level of funding for that. As part of the House Bill 5100 reductions, those services have been scaled back significantly for this biennium, and so we need to keep that in mind as we're listening to the program discussions. So that is my overview of their budget and the budget drivers. This memo that I gave you also lists the budget notes for the agency that were for the at that point two divisions and offices within the department as they were structured during the 2001 session, and the agency will talk about those as we go through their budget presentations. There were no Secretary of State audit reports on the programs here during the interim. There were some interim reports and studies, most related to the federal funding in the child welfare programs. And the Department of Human Services also contracted for a study of their child protective services intake process as a result of the Clackamas cases last year. And the agency will talk about that as we get into the budget presentations as well. I do have a copy of that report if anyone wants to see it. There's no fee adjustments. The programs do collect a few fees related primarily to various adoption services that they provide, but there's no adjustments in those that are proposed. And then I note that the child support program was issued during last session and has been reported on this interim to the Joint Judiciary Committee relative to who should have responsibility for not only performing some of the functions but also for administering the program as the state's designated agency. And so you will see that issue coming up as we work through their budget. The two relevant issues that I highlighted here for you, just to put in your mind to think about as we go through this, are the effects of that federal reauthorization of the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program and the effects of Oregon economy on the self-sufficiency programs. And then as we're scaling back prevention and early intervention programs, both in the Department of Human Services budget and in the Commission on Children and Families, what impact will that have on the substitute care caseloads, foster care and treatment caseloads in this budget, and the state's ability to meet federal requirements relative to its child welfare programs? So that's a programmatic issue that the committee may keep in mind as we go through this. So that's my summary.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Baker?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I want to go ahead and donate a contribution to Rosie.
I am the official recorder, you know.
Right. And I figure this won't be all I'll owe, so I'm just going to put that down as a down payment.
Okay. Okay.
My name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm heading up an area called Children, Adults, and Families. As you all know, in 2001, the legislature passed House Bill 2294. And in effect, the Department of Human Services was given permission to integrate policy and programs across the department rather than having the old silos or the old divisions. What happened with this for us is the Division of Adult and Family Services and a new division called the State Office for Services to Children and Families, which some of you knew as CSD. There's violation number one. That's Children's Services Division. These two came together to form the Children, Adults, and Families, which we sometimes call CAF, and I'll try not to call CAF today. These two coming together, the positive thing about this, I believe, is that it philosophically allows the state to look at our public assistance programs as opportunities to preserve families. As we talk about the TANF program, or the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, keep in mind that every one of those families has children in it, at least one child. And it's a real opportunity for us to look at, as we're saying, Sheila's talking about the reauthorization, the possibilities around self-sufficiency. While self-sufficiency is the primary goal for the temporary assistance to needy families, it's also very important to remember that this also is meaningful for the children in these families. It's important that these children are nurtured. It's important that these children are in school. And this is one of our goals. As we look at generations of families maybe who have had to depend on public assistance, what we're working with is not just the parent in that family, but also the children in that family. So as we begin talking about these programs, we thought we would start with the programs that are what we consider least intrusive. In other words, those programs that families might come in, an individual might come in and apply for help with a particular issue. And then as we move across the programs, we go to those programs that end up being the most intrusive programs. And those are things like Child Protective Services, things that are going to be heavily regulated by statute, as they should be, because in those situations we're talking about the livelihoods of children and whether or not children remain with their families. So the overview of self-sufficiency, and there are seven general categories with self-sufficiency. The first is the food stamp program, and depending on time, we may get to that program today. And Arlene Wright will be presenting the food stamp program. As we've said earlier, it's a federal program, and it's intended to protect the nutrition of low-income persons. Interestingly, it started out in the early 70s, and people actually did use food stamps. There were coupons that were used. And now we have electronic benefits transfer, and there's an Oregon Trail card, and so individuals may purchase their groceries through the Oregon Trail card. Employment-related daycare is another one of the services in self-sufficiency, and it's designed to help low-income working families be able to pay their child care bills. Temporary Assistance to Needy Families offers actual assistance to families, low-income families, and it replaced an old program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children, the AFDC program, which was based purely on eligibility and giving out a benefit. And when you hear people talk about welfare reform in the mid-90s, this was the dramatic change. We went from just having an eligibility program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children to actually having a program where we are trying to work with families to help families become self-sufficient. The Job Opportunity and Basic Skills, or what we call the JOBS program, focuses on helping clients enter the workforce, helping them find jobs, and supporting them as they move away from public assistance. And emergency services are those things that provide one-time cash assistance to help low-income families who have a short-term emergency need. The refugee program, which is also part of self-sufficiency, and this is on page 2-3, the refugee program assists refugees to successfully resettle in Oregon by providing certain services for those families. And then prevention services. There are some prevention services in our self-sufficiency area, and those include things like teen pregnancy prevention and something called the community safety net. And so while these programs comprise the largest part of our budget, we then look at those programs that become a bit more intrusive in terms of child welfare services. And there are three general categories for child welfare services. One is child protective services. Many of you have heard of child protection or have read about it in various news articles, and that's the process where we handle abuse and neglect reports that come into the agency throughout the state of Oregon. It's a collaborative effort done with the local law enforcement, with courts, as well as treatment providers. There's also quite a bit of oversight, and sometimes that is overlooked. But when we are involved in child protective services, frequently the court will be involved. And always, if a child has to come into out-of-home care, which is the second large service area, then judges are involved, court-appointed special advocates may be involved, citizen review board is involved, attorneys are involved. So as we talk about these various services, we'll be describing to you some of the oversight that's built in by statute to make sure that there's accountability in the system, again, because of the type of work that we're doing in removing children from families and making decisions about whether or not children return. Judges actually do make those decisions. But this is something we will be explaining as we go through the child welfare.
I do know that there was going to be some individualized questions in the child protective services piece. Now, are you going to go back and take each of those programs individually, and they can ask questions at that point?
Madam Chair, that is what we're going to do. I'm supposed to just give, I think you had a 40,000 view, now you're getting a 20,000 view, and then we're going to be on the ground soon.
Okay.
And that'll be the exciting part, because that's when the program directors come up and actually start talking about the details.
Okay.
So I'm sort of that mid-course right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. And adoption services, then lastly, includes guardianship and adoptions, and it's an area that Oregon has actually exceeded in. We've done quite a few adoptions. You'll hear about the increase we've had over the last 4 years in adoptions. And I'm always quick to say that's a wonderful thing for a child for whom adoption is the plan. But we also have to keep in mind it says something as a commentary on our society in this country if we have too many children needing to be placed for adoption, because it means that at the front end, families are not really getting whatever we need to provide families or the community has to provide to help families stay together to start with. The mission for this part of the department is to establish policies and programs which provide self-sufficiency for families and adults and safe and permanent families for Oregon's abused, neglected, and or dependent children. And if you think of this as a two-part mission, I think you are probably accurate. We've tried to play around with this statement and make it one concept, but we had a difficult time with that. I think both are important. Self-sufficiency is so critical to families in order for families to be able to care for their children. At the same time, we will always have cases that become known to child protection that aren't known to our public assistance programs. Likewise, in public assistance, the majority of the families known to public assistance programs will never become known to child welfare. And so I think it's important that we keep those concepts in mind. So we want to do, as we talk about service integration, we'll talk about how we work together if a family is known to public assistance, for example, to the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program or to the food stamp program, and the family becomes known to child welfare. But keep in mind, in terms of sheer numbers, most families seeking TANF or temporary assistance will not become known to the child welfare system at any point. And so that's an important concept, I think, as we think about these programs. Any questions about that? Okay, the goals, as you see there, first goal is to help people find and keep jobs and advance to better employment. Secondly, to provide accurate and timely benefits for whatever that family is applying for. To help prevent the need for public assistance in future generations, that's a key place where children and the teens in these families are very critical for us. Help protect children and promote child safety in the child's own home. And then for those children who can't remain safely in their own homes, to help those children live in other homes where they'll be nurtured and cared for and have safety, stability, and continuity. The statutory authority you'll see on page 26, and I won't bother to go into that. I think it's fairly detailed there. We have both Oregon administrative rules and we have Oregon revised statutes that govern all of the programs that we do in children, adults, and families. And that's followed by an organizational chart, which you will see on page 2-7. And that's showing the individuals that in those positions as our executive team. And then it shows also things such as the FTEs and so forth. And you may have questions to come back to on this as we go through the individual programs as well. In terms of our service delivery, the cluster that we are in, the children, adults, and families, we provide policy coordination and development. We develop contracts and do monitoring of contracts along with our contracts unit and administrative services. We're responsible for the federal policy compliance monitoring and reporting, program monitoring through what we call quality assurance, system support, coordination of grants and consultation, and training for child welfare and self-sufficiency field staff. So we are responsible for the programmatic training of those folks. And then one unique thing is we also have centralized adoptions in this state. So there is some direct client contact for adoptions out of our centralized adoptions area. And you'll hear much more about that when we get to the adoptions piece of the presentation. The services we provide, we interact with our field service delivery managers, with direct service staff, community stakeholders, our federal policymakers, contacts with our state legislators, and with other agency representatives. We work in a number of advisory committees.
Hold on for a minute. Let me ask everybody at this time to please check your purses and your pockets for cell phones.
Madam Chair, I think that he needs to pay Piggy for that.
Well, that's a good one. I would have to say that.
Okay.
Because it's quite disruptive.
It's okay. You can feed our Piggy.
Are we all clear? Okay. Just go forward.
Thank you. We also coordinate training for our child welfare programs through an agreement with Portland State University. We have a partnership with the School of Social Work, and so they are actually able to attract federal funding to supplement general funds to train our child welfare workers here in Oregon. We have two critical statutory advisory groups that we work with throughout the biennium. One of those is the Family Services Review Commission, and this is the commission that represents the public assistance programs. As you can see there on page 2-9, there's a definition straight out of statute about the responsibilities of that committee. And that committee meets once a month, and those members are actually gubernatorial appointees. We also have, by statute, a Child Welfare Advisory Committee. And that's a 21-member committee, and it's very active in assisting us in the child welfare area with any kind of policy implementation or looking at broad issues, looking at federal compliance issues, and so forth.
I think that's a good thing for the public to know, that the agency is not in a vacuum and making decisions regarding our children in the state, but that you do have a policy advisory group.
Yes, we do.
That is ongoing.
And, Madam Chair, that's a very active committee, and some of the folks that are appearing before you all with some of the other agencies are members of that committee. If you'd like, we could get you a one-pager of the membership of both of these committees, if that would be helpful.
See, I think that makes sense, so that when there are serious issues in the state regarding our children and when there are this clackamous situations that happen, and people think that the state is making decisions in a vacuum, I think it's your best-kept secret, so maybe you want to unsecretize it.
That was a great idea, Madam Chair. Thank you.
You know, because I think that to have an advisory group of citizens who are involved in the decision-making process, it lets other people in the state know that you're not just a group of bureaucrats making decisions, but you have people on the ground. So put that one down, Ramona, for you guys
okay.
to do.
And, Madam Chair, one of the things we have tried to do with both of these committees, the Child Welfare Committee, those appointees are made by Director Thorne. But we have tried to invite folks to those committees who represent various points of view. So we haven't tried to just get together those folks we think will agree with us, but actually bring some of our critics to the forum and hear what they have to say and be approachable about those kinds of issues. So those two committees, I think, have worked very well. I know for me personally, it's a great place to go with ideas and things that are coming to us from throughout the public. And both of the memberships in both groups, as I said, have key advocates from throughout the state and throughout both areas of interest. And, in fact, Senator Shields serves as a member of the Family Services Review Commission. In terms of agency-wide performance measures, we have given you sort of a teaser here of five of those, and you will be hearing about these in great detail when we get through the program descriptions. Two of these are in the child welfare area, and they go to the Links to Oregon Benchmarks document. And one of those is the median number of months from the date of the last removal from home to finalized adoption. This is a federal requirement, one that Congress endorses, because as we take children from their families and if children are unable to go back home, we have to be consistent in looking at how long does it take then for us to find an adoptive home for that child. The message is clear. It's not okay for children simply to wait in foster care. So children either need to be returning home or we need to be finding another alternate placement. So that's one measurement we will be reporting our results on. And another one is the percent of abused and neglected children who are re-abused within 6 months of prior victimization. And this, again, is a federal measurement, but a very good measurement to kind of see how well is the system doing in protecting children once we become involved in the case. There's a presumption here that in good practice, if you have a case of a child that where the case is substantiated, the child has been abused or neglected, that once the agency becomes involved, we should be reducing the opportunity for abuse or neglect to happen a second time. And that's what this measurement speaks to. And so we will be reporting some results and some targets on this one as well. In the area of self-sufficiency, you will see five of our benchmarks, which also are links to Oregon Benchmarks document. And these are the percent of temporary assistance to needy families, adults placed for whom employment is a goal, and that means placed in an employment situation. The percent of TANF cases who do not return or are off cash assistance 18 months after exit due to employment. In other words, there has been some concern that maybe families would get into jobs and then those jobs wouldn't last and those folks would end up being out of assistance and also out of employment. So this measurement actually tries to look at how many of those families are still, the parents are still employed at the end of this period of time.
Ramon, I do recall last session that we had some questions in terms of those persons who were still a part of the system in that they might be in the workplace, but they were either still receiving some level of child support or some level of health benefits. And so, you know, the state's engagement as it relates to the Jobs Plus piece. And so will we, in the Jobs Plus piece, be talking about that?
Madam Chair, we'll make sure that that is included probably tomorrow in the TANF discussion to look at who's still on and what kinds of assistance they're receiving.
Exactly.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Third is the number of female Oregonians ages 15 to 17 per 1,000 that are pregnant. The goal, of course, hoping that they won't be, as opposed to a goal of making sure more are. Yes, thank you. The percent of child care providers who are providing enhanced quality of care. We'll have some discussion in the employment-related daycare section about what that means, an enhanced quality of care. And then the ratio of Oregonians receiving food stamps to the number of Oregonians living in poverty. And, of course, this is a very critical issue because we know that Oregon ranks very high, if not the highest state in the nation, in terms of hunger. So we will be having some discussion as we talk about that measurement with the food stamp program. There are several factors that affect our services. Some of those have been alluded to already, and I think Sheila spoke to several. But the fact is that child welfare and self-sufficiency services rely heavily on federal funding, about 78% of the children, adults, and families budget is federal dollars. And, of course, when you're receiving federal dollars, what you have is you have certain policy expectations that are placed upon us, and these are subject to ongoing legislative and rulemaking changes. Among the most critical, one of those mentioned earlier, is the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And this was passed by Congress in 1997, and Oregon actually passed its complying legislation in 1999, although Oregon already had made an effort in this regard with the Best Interest of the Child legislation in 1997. But this particular piece of legislation requires certain court involvement, adds certain complexities to legal reviews, again, around due process for children and due process for families. So these are very positive things, but we just want to note that they have increased some of the work effort around the child welfare system, and they are one of those factors that will continue to influence how we do child welfare. TANF reauthorization has already been mentioned, and we will be hearing a presentation specifically around that reauthorization. We think that, excuse me.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You say it's expected to alter. Which direction is it going to go?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, we have operated under a waiver here in Oregon called the Oregon Option. And in that waiver, we've been able to avoid things like strict time limits on how long people might receive assistance. And we've also been able to have some flexibility in defining what might be a work activity. We believe that what Congress is discussing now may, in fact, if we are not able to continue our waiver, which is probably not very likely that we will be able to continue that waiver, and if that does happen, we will be forced to look at some of the same stringent requirements that Congress has placed nationwide with the TANF reauthorization, will place with the TANF reauthorization.
Does that include food stamps?
That does not include, the TANF reauthorization, does not include the food stamp piece. There is, as you'll look on down in the next two bullets down, Food Stamp Farm Security and Rural Investment Act has mandated certain things, but the idea behind that is to increase food stamp participation. So that's another federal piece of legislation that we have to respond to. But we are going to have, and hopefully you all will look forward to quite a bit of discussion around the reauthorization, because Michael Buckley will do that piece. And it does have a lot of implications for Oregon and how we have successfully done welfare reform in the state.
Thank you.
The issue of child care, federal child care funding strongly emphasizes the importance of parental choice when you're making child care arrangements. And the idea behind that is that if parents receive a child care subsidy, they should have the same access to child care arrangements that other parents have who are not receiving a subsidy. So that kind of federal requirement also has implications for how we do the employment-related daycare.
Yes. Are we doing a better job? I know I date myself along these lines in terms of child care in the state, but it appears to me that quite a few situations have come out in terms of careful checking and monitoring of child care providers in terms of those who are caring for 10 or more kids. How are we doing along those lines in terms of technical assistance to those people or to those providers, or are we doing a better job in terms of checking on the care, the quality of care for the children in those centers?
Madam Chair, would you be offended if I deferred that question until tomorrow?
Not at all.
Because we're going to have employment-related daycare.
Yes. Okay.
And I would like for us to get into that because there are some differences over the last couple of years that you've alluded to. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next bullet is Medicaid compliance, and this is kind of a shared responsibility that we're not the only place in the organization that must pay attention to Medicaid compliance, but we do have a medical policy unit that monitors some of the state's implementation of Title 19, which is Medicaid, and Title 21, which is the CHIPS program, or the Children's Health Insurance Program. And again, we have to respond to whatever changes come out of Washington with the Medicaid program. Family factors, and I think Sheila did a nice job of sort of highlighting some of these. The drug use, that is a huge concern in this state, and I know one that Senator Winters often speaks to or has spoken to in the past. The use of methamphetamines by families has significant ramifications for all of the work we do in human services. Child care access, the very question that was just brought up. Whether or not parents have access is one question, and then whether or not the what they have access to is of quality care. Those are growing concerns, not just here in Oregon, but across the country, because we anticipate as more families are more or less forced into the job market with the changes that might come with reauthorization, this has huge implications for who's going to take care of their children. The increased demand for child care, which is that very next bullet, is what I'm referencing there. And then another factor is we have quite a few special needs children in our system, and we have hard-to-serve clients. And these are individuals who might have mental illnesses or individuals who have other kinds of problems associated with alcoholism or drugs. All of these pieces require a more intense level of case management in working with these families or individuals or children. And one of the things we know that often poverty is a concurrent condition with both child welfare and self-sufficiency clients that exacerbates the situation, which may bring the client actually to our attention. In terms of the community relationship changes that are happening, those kinds of factors, I would reference that we have some key advisory committees, and I see Senator Shields has joined us, and I thank him for his participation on one of our committees, Family Services Review Commission. Judicial involvement has increased, again, as a result of some of the federal child welfare legislation. And then we have various advocacy groups that we meet with. While we have the two statutory advisory committees, we have a number of other advocacy groups. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we appreciate the willingness of folks to come to the table and help us sort through very complex issues. And I personally am a big believer in getting that kind of advice before decisions are made. We've had our two statewide advisory committees, the statutory ones, meeting separately, but they, in fact, did have their first meeting where they came together in January, I believe it was, to talk about TANF reauthorization because it has implications for child welfare as well as for families on public assistance. Some of the support service demands and preventative service demands, you see a list there on page 216. These are things that ordinarily would happen at the community level. We do want to say that this could influence services because as mental health services and alcohol and drug treatment services, domestic violence services, daycare housing, those kinds of services, if they become more limited or diminished completely at the local level, we probably will see these kinds of factors influencing who is referred to the Department of Human Services for assistance and for help. And many of those services, if they're provided locally early when we know about a case, they're able to enable a family to stabilize or maybe not come further into the system. So that is one of the factors that we think will affect our services over the next few years.
Yeah, just one question. What will happen since Multnomah County has cut services, mental health dollars in Multnomah County for children? What will happen to children who are having mental health problems that are going to school within those families?
I think, Madam Chair, that when Barry Cass testifies in a few weeks, he's going to be talking about the mental health services piece specifically around children, and we'll make a note to have him be sure and look at the Multnomah situation in particular.
Please do. Thank you.
The judges are quite distressed by this, as you can imagine. I met with a group of judges in Multnomah on Friday, and one of the things that we are required to do by federal law is if we're going to remove children from their families, or if we're making decisions about whether or not children can go back home, we have to do something called reasonable efforts. And with our tribal families, we have to do something called active efforts. And the judge has to rule on whether or not we have met that standard. And the question it has raised is it reasonable to expect a family to access or a parent to access drug treatment if drug treatment is not available now in their community? So it's raised a lot of concerns in terms of our federal compliance and our compliance with our tribal agreements in terms of being able to make those kinds of services available to families. The judges realize that we are in a difficult situation. I mean, they are Oregonians, and they realize there aren't any easy answers, so we're trying to work with the judiciary around these issues to make it less contentious for our staff.
Question, Senator Morse?
A question with respect to the reductions in the budgets and shifting of services. Is there any active effort to integrate, or at least by referral, to the faith-based service efforts that are being made in our communities to network with those services?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I can't speak to the efforts in the alcohol and drug community in particular or the mental health, but I know in the social services community some of our partnerships are with faith-based providers. This has been more customary in residential care, for example, some of the providers of services for children. These have always often been and for many years have been faith-based communities. But I think there are opportunities there, and I know that Senator Shields has brought this to the Family Services Review Commission, and it's certainly something that we should consider to try to be active in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other considerations, again, TANF reauthorization, that one pops up again because we do believe during the year 2003 Congress will make some decisions about the reauthorization. Then you see Program Improvement Plan. This is a result of a federal review we had in the Child Welfare Program. And in June of this past year, We negotiated a program improvement plan with the federal government, and as long as we are able to achieve certain benchmarks with that plan, we can avoid penalties. And so that's what our goal is, to continue to improve child welfare, not just to meet the conditions of the plan, but also to improve the system itself in this state. 4E eligibility review, we did pass one of those, and for those who don't know 4E eligibility, that's a federal funding source for children who are in the foster care system and who would have been eligible or were eligible for temporary assistance to needy families. It actually goes back to the old aid to families with dependent children. The look back is to 1996, so it's a rather complex system, but it does allow us to draw down federal dollars to support certain children in the foster care system. Also, we had a visit on our statewide automated child welfare information system, which is called SACLIS. That's the federal name. In our state, it's called FACIS, F-A-C-I-S. They came out and reviewed our automated system, which we are required to be in compliance with certain federal standards, and we are still awaiting their recommendations. We don't have that final report yet, and so when that comes, that will also be something that we will need to pay attention to. The issue of legal representation, and this is another one that I know that it's dear to Senator Winter's heart. We've discussed this on several occasions. But at this point, we often will have child welfare workers who go to court on child welfare cases, usually children who are in foster care, and we do not have legal representation for the agency in many of these situations. This is a bit unique as you look at child welfare across the country, and in that most states have had to find some ways of having legal representation. In fact, in many states in court, you wouldn't be allowed to go without having legal representation.
Ramona, I know that you cannot, yes. Cannot base policy decisions regarding our children in the state on what you hear on the TV, but did you hear last week when news media basically was commenting about having some of those workers in the court, like it's a waste of money just for them to sit there to be. Did you see this?
Madam Chair, I did not see that, but I have heard this before, that if the system doesn't run tightly, what happens is staff will go and they will wait their turn to go into court. And people, states have taken various means of trying to do something different with that, like providing a laptop computer so the person who is sitting in the hall waiting to get into the courtroom can continue to do some kind of work. And some courts have done better jobs than others in terms of trying to streamline the time frame and not have everybody come and wait outside in the halls.
But if you didn't have legal representation there, how are we going to have fairness for the kids?
That's an excellent question, Madam Chair, and one that keeps me awake at night. Now, children sometimes will have legal representation, and they will sometimes have a court-appointed special advocate, which is excellent when they do. Parents are to be provided legal representation, and so what happens in essence is sometimes the caseworker will be the one person who doesn't have legal representation. So the agency, and what represents the agency then, is the goodwill of the caseworker in that circumstance. This is one that we have put forth a policy package and did, in fact, this last during the biennium. But, of course, with the funding the way it is not realistic at this point. But we have a kind of exhausted opportunities to look at any other ways of doing this without having the legal representation piece. And I always just want to put it as a marker, because I think it's a critical one that we need to keep coming back to, and hopefully we won't always be in the financial situation that we're in right now.
Question, Senator?
Yes, you just mentioned the court-appointed special advocates. I assume by definition all the children would be qualified to have one. Is that right?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, they are qualified to have one as they come into custody of the agency.
So what percentage of them actually have? And we heard this from a young lady a few weeks ago when she talked here. What percentage actually have a CASA volunteer?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, I believe it's approximately 20%.
One out of five.
Correct.
What happens to the
other four? His question, what happens to the other four?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, the other four do not have the advantage of having that special advocate. Their cases will still proceed. The other safeguards are in place. The Citizen Review Board will still occur. There will still be the judicial hearings. They still have the requirement of having a case plan. They may, in fact, have an attorney. But the state has not been able to fund a 100% CASA program across the state, is my understanding. This was an issue that I found out about when I came here a few years ago.
Just one follow-up.
Sir?
It's a volunteer program, but it takes money to administer the volunteer program. Is it a shortage of volunteers that limits its growth, or is it a shortage of money to manage, train, whatever the volunteers? Which is the sticking point?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, I believe that Donna Middleton, she's well aware of this issue. We've discussed it. We have a belief that there are many people who would volunteer, but there's not an existing infrastructure statewide in every county that would allow someone to recruit the volunteers, train the volunteers. So in answer to your question, it seems to be an infrastructure issue because we've never recruited to the level we might would if that infrastructure existed.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, in the Commission on Children and Families budget, in their agency request budget, there was a package that asked for some additional funding for the CASA program, Court Appointed Special Advocate program. There was a task force, I believe, last biennium that did some work on this and looked at how would you expand this statewide, and they came up with a basically, I believe, a three-biennium plan. The first biennium's expansion would cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 to $4 million general fund, is what I remember. Right now their funding is slightly, I think it's about $1.5 million. And that funding runs through the commission, goes to the counties to support the volunteer programs. But unless, as we heard in the testimony, unless you have the people to train the volunteers, you can't bring the volunteers in. So it is a budget issue, I believe, rather than a lack of interest or a lack of valuing their services. It's a budget issue.
Thank you. Other things, outdoor youth program monitoring. In 2001, the legislature did pass House Bill 3330 and requesting that our agency license outdoor youth programs. And we put this in only as a footnote because the funding for that was canceled. However, we have gone forward, and we do have, presently, we have three of those programs licensed. There was an additional program that was licensed briefly, and then it ceased operations later. And that was their own board's decision. So that's just a note for that. Right now, it's something that we have been doing. Then the other factors, food stamp caseload, which we will perhaps get to in just a few minutes, that has continued to increase quickly and significantly. And I've already spoken about the reasonable efforts and active efforts piece. We have a number of agreements in children, adults, and families. We have agreements related to with the tribes in order to secure child welfare funds for the tribes in this state. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Citizens Review Board. I've mentioned the agreement with Portland State University. We also co-chair a group called Community Safety Net with the Commission on Children and Families. And these efforts, and you'll hear a little more about them with prevention, these efforts are aimed towards preventing abuse and neglect. We work with the Oregon Youth Authority in looking at programs, shelter services, and so forth for teens that might be crossing over between the two populations of social services and youth authority. And then we also have a Title IV-E waiver. And the Title IV-E waiver allows us to expend money that would be spent for a child in foster care. We can actually spend that money to keep the child out of care or get the child back home quickly. And this is another waiver that's critical for us because it has an expiration of July 31st, 2003, and we are going to be requesting to have that extended because we have been able to show cost neutrality with that particular waiver. Then we have a number of self-sufficiency-related agreements. If you look at the list, I'll just highlight those because we'll talk about those at some length when Michael Buffley presents. The Job Opportunity Basic Skills Program, there's a whole system of contracting for employment and training services for individuals. The Food Stamp Employment and Training Program, again, this is one where we contract for services such as training, education, and job search. Education service districts and school districts, we have contracts with them. Health services, the use of public health nurse services to identify medical issues and so forth. Mental health services, counselors to help identify mental health issues. Alcohol and drug issues, a similar kind of arrangement. Housing and community services, community action agencies. Health and Human Services, we have teen pregnancy prevention in school, completion, jobs, programs for jobs participants, and we have relationships with community colleges. We have agreements with them. our cost-cutting and efficiency efforts. We have, Oregon has aggressively sought to maximize federal funding in the child welfare area, and one of the things we have done is to implement targeted case management, and this allows us to draw down certain federal dollars in child welfare in the amount of $105 million each biennium. Also, the TANF caseload, it's interesting to note that had it remained at its 1994 levels, it would be costing the state approximately $242.2 million more to finance the program now than what it's actually costing. You will also see a small list there of additional cost-cutting measures, and these are things that have been applicable across the department. With the exception of that last bullet, we did move some of our research function up to PSU, Portland State University.
You cut yourself on that one.
I'm sorry?
You cut yourself on that
acronym.
I did. That's right. Thank you. The interim audit reports, as we said, we had a federal review in 01, and we received a finalized program improvement plan in 02. We also had a federal 4E review. We passed that one in 02. The next one we have will be a couple of years out. It'll be a little more difficult because they make the standards more stringent each time you go through one of those reviews. And then I mentioned the statewide automated child welfare information systems. And then lastly, the one that Sheila mentioned earlier, as a result of the Ashley Pond case in Clackamas County, we had a review of the child protective services intake process. And when we get to the presentation on child protection, we can tell you about where we are with the recommendations from that report and the kinds of things we learned about our system. So, Madam Chair, if there are other questions, before we move to the...
You must be doing good.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. Again, I'm Pam Teschner from the Office of Budget and Management. And you should have in front of you the handout that says on the front of it, 2003-05 Governor's Budget. Yes, that's it. Got a border around the outside, looks like a spiral. And I will be flying you back up to a high level that Sheila was at about 40,000 feet and giving you just an overview of the budget of children, adults, and families and how we arrived at what we did. So please feel free to interrupt me if you need to ask any questions, and I'll see what I can do to answer them. The first page there, it's actually numbered page 2, is that box that shows progression over time of the budget to where we have landed with the governor's budget, 2003-05 governor's budget. You'll see that the total funds now are at $1.5 billion, which is an increase of about 2.4% above the close of session. General fund, though, dropped about $42 million, which was almost a 17% reduction from close of session. The position... We'll be looking at that a little bit, but as Sheila said, most of the staffing for this area is what you'll be looking at in maybe a week or so in community human services. But as the department reorganized, some of the positions associated with this area of self-sufficiency and child welfare moved either into the field side or into central department-wide support services, so there was a reduction of staff in this cluster because of that reorganization and transfer. And there was a few reductions from the reorg. The next page, page 3, is a pie chart of total funds. And you can see how those total funds, again, I think this is information that has been touched on already. Both Sheila and Ramona have mentioned that federal funds make up about 78% of this budget. And you can see how that splits out. The top piece there, the 31% federal funds, is what Sheila was calling limited federal funds. That is, for the most part, temporary assistance for needy families. And a chunk of it also is child welfare. And the federal funds non-limited is food stamps.
Question? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 2, the federal funds are significantly less than the 0103 fifth special session. Could you explain why that has reduced?
The federal funds.
$475 million, that line item, in the 035 governor's budget. It's showing significantly fewer federal funds than existed in this 0103 budget.
Pam, is that the piece where it was reduced from federal and be applied to the children's piece?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I'll look into that a little deeper, but I think that it's related to that position shift. The positions that moved into department-wide support services with the reorg and with people moving from one place to another, what over this biennium, I believe that that's a result of those positions moving. But I'll verify that for you. And
let me speak check that.
Madam Chair, Senator, in the 2103 budget for these agencies, there was some carry forward money from previous years, federal funds carried forward, and those were used to replace general fund in the budget for 2103. They're not available for 2305. At least we don't know that there are significant carry forward funds. We don't expect significant carry forward funds, and so the federal funds get pulled out of the budget, and there's general fund backfill for those amounts to keep the programs at the same level. So I don't know the exact number, but that is another factor in the reduction in federal funds. We had a higher level of federal funds available to us for 2103 because of funds that were carried forward from the 9901 biennium.
And those were the Medicaid upper payment limits?
It was not that in this budget. There were some additional temporary assistance to needy families money. There were some social services block grant funds. I believe those were the two major sources where we did some fund shifting in this budget.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, a little bit further into the presentation, there is some information about that cost shift that Sheila was talking about with that one-time money in 0103. So we'll get to that. And, yes, that's a part of the answer as well. Okay. Page 4. And that brings that the total funds budget for this cluster for children, adults, and families increased just about 1% from the legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. However, the information below that takes a look at a very big overview of some of the major changes that occurred from the close of session through the fifth special session. So, and this also includes some emergency board action. This is just to give you an idea of what some of those larger ones changes were. You'll be looking at those in greater detail as we get a little bit further into this, but I just wanted to put those down so you had an idea of what has happened over time since the close of session. Ramona has done a great job going through what programs and services are included in the governor's budget. As she said, this cluster is split into basically self-sufficiency and child welfare programs and services. So that just touches on that. You'll be getting a lot more information about that later on. Page 5, another pie chart of the $1.5 billion total funds. You can see that a little over $1 billion of it, at 73%, is in self-sufficiency, which, again, the majority of that's food stamps, but some of that is temporary assistance for needy families. The next biggest piece is substitute care, which is your foster care, and then the next piece of significance is the adoption assistance. So, again, that just shows you how it breaks out, gives you a sense of proportion. Yes.
Pam, in terms of substitute care, does that mean not just foster families, but when respite care is a part of this substitute care?
Ramona, can you?
Madam Chair, this would include relative care. It would include residential care.
Right.
And respite, if it's being provided as part of foster care.
Right.
Yes, that would be.
But it's such a noticeably big chunk, and I just think that it's deserving of being told what this is. That's great. That's
yes, Madam Chair. See, it includes both the payments for foster care as well as all of the administration of the program itself.
Okay. Thank you. The next pie chart on page 6 takes again that same $1.5 billion total funds and shows how that splits out by category. Again, it's very good visual as to what proportion of this budget is going out in special payments, 92% of the budget, or about $1.4 billion are spent on food stamps, temporary assistance for needy family, and the substitute care that Ramona was just talking about, foster care, adoption assistance. And another piece there, services and supplies, 6% personal services, has been mentioned again earlier that you'll see a difference in the proportion when you look at community human services where the field staff, the direct service delivery staff are. The page 7, I'd like to highlight that second bullet, legislatively approved actions through the April 2002. What I've bulleted there is primarily things that came out of the February e-board and special session. Again, we'll see some of these a little bit later too, but there was money added, $12.5 million in general fund due to the growth in the temporary assistance for needy families caseload. The job opportunity and basic skills program was reduced. And that was reduced so that the Jobs Plus program could be half of it could be restored. In the February e-board, the Jobs Plus program was cut by $2.6 million. And so the Job Opportunity and Basic Skills program was cut in half so that half of that, that money could be used to restore half of Jobs Plus. So, and then Emergency Assistance Program was reduced by a little over $1 million. And the student daycare program by about $1 million. Base budget adjustments, the result of position actions that occurred in 2001-03 that were rolled up, and the compensation changes cut the nearly $20 million of general fund from the budget. Again, that's largely due to the fact that positions were moved around within the department. Some of them, though, were eliminated. The essential packages, some of them are not very significant. I think one of them to point out on page 8 is package 020, which is the phase-in, phase-out programs. There was a $6 million reduction in total funds and about $1 million in general fund from phasing out, and that was due, for the most part, to the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program, also known as CAMI, was transferred to the Department of Justice. You can see how much inflation, when you add price list adjustments and inflation to this budget, how much it adds in total funds and general fund. But as George Naughton mentioned yesterday, late in the process, as we were pulling this budget together, and there was a need to reduce further as a result of the December forecast, we eliminated inflation. And so you'll see a little bit further down that in package 092, the inflation was eliminated. 040 is the mandated caseload package where funds are added to cover increases in the mandated caseloads. And in this instance, it's foster care, adoption assistance, and supportive remedial daycare. Adoption assistance making up about $18 million of the total funds, and foster care about $9 million. Now, here's what we were just discussing a little bit ago. It was called the 050 package, the for fund shifts, and it amounted to about $36 million that, in as Sheila said, in temporary assistance for needy families, social services block grant, and there was some other fund carry forward from Jobs Plus individual education account. Those, I believe, last biennium general fund was reduced because of that carryover of the federal fund and some other fund, and so the general fund is brought back up to backfill as a result of that one-time revenue not being carried forward into 0305 and to maintain program levels. The next page, page 9, We had a technical adjustment of $8 million reduction, and that was primarily because that was just a transfer of money from children, adults, and families to the mental health area to pay for services, mental health treatment for the foster kids. Apparently some billings came in late, so payments went out after the initial budget was submitted, so we have an $8 million reduction, which was just a transfer of money. Policy packages, I think, let's look at the 084, which is November 2002 e-board. The other first two didn't amount to a lot of money. There, from the November e-board, was the first somewhat significant reductions. There was, however, food stamp caseload increase. It was about a $10 million federal fund increase from food stamp caseload. And with programmatic reductions, the total funds were increased about $2.8 million. The reductions, I highlighted three of those, the Jobs Plus elimination. Student daycare was eliminated. And as a result of reorganizing and consolidating services within the department, that also reduced general fund by $1.3 million, which was about 21 positions that were reduced or cut. The next page lists, some of the major cuts that came out of the fifth special session, Section 2. The cuts that were identified by the department as across-the-board reductions for 2001-03 were rolled into 2003-05. And as a result, we have a nearly $53 million reduction in total funds and nearly $41 million in general fund. And I've highlighted what some of those larger impacts are. Job Opportunity and Basic Skills program being cut about $1.3 million. I think we've mentioned the employment-related daycare cut. Now, that $11.5 million is a result of a number of actions being taken, reductions to that program, and from increasing co-pays to decreasing the income eligibility limit from 185% of the federal poverty level down to 150%. So we tightened down eligibility a little bit and increased co-pays. And that's where we got the $11.5 million general fund savings. The temporary assistance for needy family grant was reduced by $5 a month. So the cash assistance grant was reduced $5 a month. That saved $2.6 million of general fund. I think Sheila or Ramona or both have mentioned the system of care. It was originally all of that money was slated to be cut and the entire system of care dollars removed at $12.4 million. But you'll see just in a little bit further down that some of that was restored by the governor. Residential treatment was cut by nearly $2 million, and foster care monthly payments in total were cut nearly $5 million. Now there's regular foster care and special rates foster care. Ramona was just talking a minute ago about special needs kids. The monthly payment for those children are higher than regular foster care, but both of those monthly payments were reduced. Adoption assistance payments were also reduced. So that really was the bulk of the reductions coming out of the fifth special session. As I mentioned, what we did beyond that was to eliminate the inflation that was contained in package 030. And as I just said, $5 million that was restored from system of care. I mention on the next page that of the $5 million that the governor restored to system of care, this cluster, children, adults, and families, took a little over $3 million of that for the flex funds. The other $2 million went into community human services, and you'll see that later to pay for staffing. So there was that restoration. I think Sheila, I think, mentioned the transfer of the child support program to the Department of Justice. All in all, there was a little over $96 million of total funds, but some of that came out of another cluster. Excuse me. About $95 million came from this cluster. And I mentioned on that last page, page 11, the add back to system of care. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Ruben, I wanted to ask in terms of the transfer for child support, why did you find that necessary to the Department of Justice, package 162?
Madam Chair, are you asking if I found that necessary?
No, why did the department find it necessary to transfer the child support piece from your department to the Department of Justice?
There had been an ongoing conversation over a couple of years about the fact that the responsibilities were split between the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services. So I think over the last biennium there have been some conversations regarding, was that the most efficient way to accomplish this, or would it be more efficient to actually move the transfer, the administrative piece that we have, over to Department of Justice. And so I think the former director, Mr. Mink, along with Attorney General Hardy Myers, agreed that probably that would be the most efficient thing for the state to do. And so we've worked closely with them. We will still be involved in a lot of the policy issues. We will still carry some responsibility along with the Department of Justice staff in looking at what are the best policies for things regarding, for example, domestic violence cases, for things regarding collection of child support of children in the foster care system. So we're not walking away from that responsibility, but believe that it's the most efficient way of doing the business. And in many states, that responsibility is housed in one place or the other, and in many states it's in the Department of Justice or their equivalent.
Thank you. Further questions? One other question I wanted to ask you, what are we doing to help foster parents adjust to the decrease that they're going to be having since we built this cottage industry in the state, and many of the people that went into them looked at that as a source of income, even though we don't like to use that term, but that's really is what it is for a lot of people who have readjusted their lives to do this.
Yes, Madam Chair, and we will spend some time when we talk about the foster care piece in particular. It's been a difficult adjustment as foster parents have realized that some of those payments will be reduced by 7.5% and others the special payments by 10%. One of the things foster parents, though, I must say, I mean, they have such a heart for the work that they do.
Right.
That for foster parents in general, it's been an issue about we want to make sure that the children we're caring for are getting what those children need, as opposed to seeing it as a reduction in, for example, their income. I mean, I know there are exceptions to that. But when foster parents have looked at the bigger budget picture and realized that even for a family in the TANF or the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, that they're actually also taking a cut, I think many foster parents said that what's going to happen is everybody's going to feel this pain. It can't be reserved for only those children. I mean, we can't preserve children in the foster care system. We certainly have a different responsibility to them. But I think people understood that when you start cutting people's welfare checks, then this is a pain that goes across all of the budget.
Thank you. No further questions?
No.
Okay.
Ooh. I think they're ready to get into the food stamp discussion.
Okay. We're going to the food stamp.
We'd like to move to the food stamp discussion now.
Uh-huh. You're just moving so fast. I think it's great.
Yeah, really.
Mm-hmm. Did you start over?
You ready?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arlene Reich, and I am the Food Stamp Program Manager within Children, Adult, and Families. And my presentation today for you will primarily be around three handouts that you should have, and they are lettered A, B, and C. Yes. I will also be referring to somewhat of the some of the content in the document that you have in your binder that is titled the Food Stamp Program. But again, the primary focus will be around those three handouts. What I want to start with is just a little bit on the background of the Food Stamp Program, and it has been touched on already. But it is a federal program, 100% funded for benefits and 50% federal match for administrative cost. The eligibility factors and benefit amounts are set by the federal government, and they also have oversight that the program is administered by individual states. And I think we all know that the food stamp program does have complexity in their policies and regulations, so it is a part of that that the states work with in administering the program. If you look on page 4-1, so the first page of your document titled Food Stamps, and look at the numbers of who is served, the program serves all households that meet the program's income and resource standards. This includes households with both single parents, two parents, seniors, persons of disabilities, young and employable adults. And if you see here, it shows you a total food stamp caseload, gives you an average and projected number, and it gives you the self-sufficiency caseload, which is a subset of that total, and then the senior people with disabilities caseload, which is the second subset of the total. Planning and coordination of implementing and delivering food stamps is with is done with seniors and people with disabilities. That being one program, I work real closely with the AAAs, the Area of Aging, Agency on Aging, and with the the service delivery areas that also have senior people disability managers that are located within the SDAs, and work closely in delivering the benefits. And that is talking about policies, corrective action, that kind of thing. If you go to handout A, and also then in your document, turn to page 4-2, what I would like to speak to is the standards, the income limits that are used for the program. So looking at handout A, you'll see a chart there that gives you persons in the filing group. It lists the categorical eligibility, which I'll talk to you about in a moment, and it gives you the persons in the need group, the income limits, adjusted income limits, and then the actual payment standard. Benefits are based on household size, income, and expenses. And an average food stamp benefit for a household is about $150 a month. Oregon has taken the opportunity for the expansion on categorical eligibility. And we are within federal compliance by looking at expanded categorical eligibility, and we're looking at the 185% federal poverty level when we are applying categorical eligibility. The reason why Oregon did that is that we believe it would help with access to our folks, opposed looking at the 130% of standard. So that second column where you look at categorical eligibility limits, you can see it's a higher standard than the countable income limit. There are a couple of situations where folks would not be eligible for categorical eligibility, and that would be if a member of the household is serving an intentional program violation or the head of the household is serving a offset disqualification. And offset is a term used for those who are working with the employment program in regards to food stamps. Is there any questions about the standards?
Madam Chair, I didn't quite catch what that first one would not be categorically eligible was.
The
head of the house was what?
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, are you asking the question, what are the two reasons why someone wouldn't be eligible for categorical eligibility? That would be that a member of the household is serving an intentional program violation. So it's fraud.
Fraud, okay.
And then the second is someone is serving an offset disqualification. And offset is the employment piece of the food stamp program. Question? Okay. Then moving on to the next handout that you have that is letter B. This is talking to you about the growth that we have had, and that has been discussed here today as well. What you have in front of you is showing you from 1995 to 2003 as of for January, for the month of January, what the caseload size has been and is to date. The numbers looking at 2000, the 17 million, that is the benefit amount that was given out in the year 2000. 2001 was the 19 million, 2002 is the 27, and then 2003 is the 31. So you can see that we have increased quite a bit in the number of cases that we are serving and the benefit amount increasing.
Question. Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 401, food stamp caseload 0103, your numbers are a little bit different.
These are averaged. If you look on page 401, those are, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, got that. The figures on 401 is giving you an average and a projected, and the bar chart is giving you the actual.
Okay, in 03, if the trend continues, that will be the actual, since we really don't know. I mean,
right, it's projected.
Yeah, okay. Another question.
Please.
Why in the years 98 and 99 we saw a decrease in the amount of food stamps? What's going on there?
There was, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there were some welfare reform changes that happened at that time.
At the federal level?
Yes, that caused some decrease in benefits. Although I want to say that DHS, or Department of Human Services, worked with our advocates and with our policymakers on working with those policy changes so that it would not cause hardships on our families that are applying. And as you can see, that with this amount of benefits that are being paid out, if you will, it does benefit our economy. And having a meeting with Dennis Stewart, who is our Western Region FNS director, he pointed out to us that every dollar of food stamp benefits that's given out, $2 comes back into the state. So, pardon me?
How's that? Beg your pardon, Madam Chair.
That's all right. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, in the conversation, the question wasn't asked to how he arrived at that. That was something that he shared with us, but I would be more than happy to get that detailed information. I just thought it was interesting that it does, having our federal dollars coming back into our economy is also a boost to our state. So I just wanted to point that out.
Senator Shields?
Well, I was going to start with a question, but partially in response to Representative Smith's question, and I'm not sure I can answer the whole question, but if you took a community, for instance, out in Baker, where there's a lot of unemployment, when you can get people signed up on food stamps and they're bringing in food stamp dollars, which are federal dollars, which don't exist, I mean, the dollars aren't there until they arrive as food stamp dollars, they begin to spend those at the local grocery store. It does stimulate economic growth, which usually they say has a multiplier effect. And mm-hmm. I would like more detail on that. But my question, around the years 98 and 99, you said there were some changes in policy that saw it drop. Mm-hmm. I would like to know more detail about what the changes in policy were, because as I recall from work on the Hunger Relief Task Force, one of the things that we saw was that the application for food stamps was more complex, and over the last few years we've done a lot to try and simplify that application and make it understandable to people and so on. Or are the changes more substantive? Can you be a little more detailed?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, what I have is that there were some changes to certain non-citizens that were looked at not being eligible to receive, and it was then also the able-bodied adults between 8 and 50 known as ABODs. So there were some changes where it gave them a limited number of months that they could be on food stamps. And so those were some of the changes that caused a decrease.
So follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senators.
What you're saying is that was a result of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act
that carried
that
yes
came went into effect and took hold here in 98 mm-hmm. 99 and Right. Just qualified people that were qualified before. And since then, I hate to say it this way, but Congress may have seen some of the error in its ways, and some changes have been made to restore some of those.
We memorialize them with your help.
That's right.
Yes.
The last part of my question is, what effect has some of the food stamp outreach that we've done had on increasing this? I was fascinated that the utilization of your third handout shows that it looks to me, if I can read right, that Oregon, does that mean that 96% of the people eligible are getting food stamps? What does that mean? And is it because of our outreach, which is shown in handout B, is that why we're growing so much, or how does this happen?
The Madam Chair, Representative, or excuse me, Senator Shields, the outreach efforts that have taken place in the last couple of years has definitely contributed to the increase in our caseload. The handout that you're referring to is not a percentage; it's a ratio. If you're the 0.94 that you're talking about,
right?
Yeah, that
is. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah,
later.
If you wouldn't be offended, I'll get to that in just a moment. Okay.
Question? Representative Smith. Thank you. Tell me about eligibility a little bit. It says here $3,000 is a limit on food stamps if you're 60 or older, and $2,000. Is that a per-year eligibility requirement, or is that a lifetime?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, $3,000 we're looking at that as a month-to-month, looking at having, you know, when a person comes in to apply, they're not able to have any more than that into an account or that would go over that amount.
Yeah,
so it could be a cumulative.
Okay, and let's say they exhaust that,
mm-hmm.
but they still qualify. Do they requalify then?
Right, that's
okay,
correct.
Okay, so your chart on your B chart, okay, those numbers that go from year to year, so conceivably the same people that qualify for food stamps in year 2000 could be the same people that qualified in 01. It could be the same people that qualified in 02. Okay. Can I make that assumption or no?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the folks that come in to apply that sometimes can qualify and not qualify. And at different times when they come in, things could change in their situations that could have them become eligible again. So I guess I would say yes, that
okay.
It could.
Follow up, Representative Smith. Well, do you keep track of how long a person has received food stamps, say, over a 10-year period? I mean, if I took food stamps in 1990 and I did it in 95 and 6, do you have a record that goes back like that to know, you know, if this is temporary assistance or if it's becoming a way of life, and are we helping these people get out into the workforce type thing? And you understand what I'm asking?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not for sure, but my guess is that yes, we do have data that could support that. I could follow up for you and get that information.
Well, I would, because I'm curious.
Okay.
Because we have 196,000 Oregonians this year that could partake of food stamps. That will probably happen, unfortunately. And we have the highest hunger rate in the nation. And I don't understand why our hunger rate is so high. I wish somebody could tell me why and have it be the truth. Do you know why?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't have the one answer. I don't think there is one answer, but my belief is that by looking at these numbers and the information that we have that shows Oregon is number one in hunger is from the 98-99-2000 figure, and you can see that we have increased in the number of folks receiving. So I think in the next 3 years spread that we receive information that Oregon will not be number one in hunger. That is my belief.
Well, that would sure be nice. And then I would like those statistics, excuse me, and I hope I communicated to you what I wanted that you understand what it is. Is that okay?
It certainly is. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I appreciate your question, and what I understood it to be is that you would like to have some data on folks that have been on, like, for the last 10 years. Do we have that data, and are we looking at that as some planning and strategy of working with how we approach in the delivery of benefits?
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, there.
We look alike.
Yeah, that's what we are. Common names, you know.
I don't think there's any reason to insult yourself. Anyway, moving on. I've been curious and tried to get information and couldn't, so I'll ask you this. Do you know how they calculated the hunger rate? I mean, we kept hearing that Oregon was number one in the United States in hunger. I never really got the information, and no one could seem to give to me how that was actually calculated. Because, you know, I just have a hard time putting that together with the reality of my life. Because I deal with these people every day. And, you know, I have a large part of my practice is people who are in the Oregon Health Plan and who are living in poverty. And I had a hard time putting that together.
Excuse me just for a minute, that's right. Ms. Baker?
I was just going to say, Madam Chair and Representative Bates, I don't know about the 1999 numbers. There is a more recent study by Brandeis University. I'm sorry, I'm not aware of the East Coast. Mm-hmm. Brandeis, yeah, mm-hmm. That one. I do have some information on that as to how they calculated it, and they put us at the highest actual hunger rate in the nation. It's a little more updated data, but only the third, if you will, of the in terms of hunger insecurity, so it may be we are making some progress, but I can get information on that more recent study. Is that what you have there?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's what I do have here in front of me and would be able to offer that up, but it sounds like that you do have that information. But what I understand, part of what goes into that process is that it is a survey that is done, actual telephone survey, and that it's been identified that the questions are asked of the head of household, and it could be folks in that household, they would not have the same answer as that head of household would be answering to the questions. So there is some of that goes into those statistics.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have data that goes back and predates the Oregon Health Plan like this, that would give us an idea of the trend? And what's behind my question is, if we are singularly the most beneficial state, Western states, with respect to assistance for the indigent, to what extent has Oregon become a magnet and us accepting a burden for persons that, when I look at California, 35% mm-hmm. of their eligible persons actually receiving food stamps, if I'm reading that correctly.
Mm-hmm. It's actually a ratio. Excuse me, Madam Chair, Senator Morse. It's a ratio, but yes, they are lower than, you know, the other states. I'm not sure if I can find out if we have that data. Right now, I can't answer that we do, but I would be willing to find that out for you.
Madam Chair, if there are any analyses or studies that have been done with respect to what we offer in this state and its impact on migration, it would be very helpful, and I think something that would be germane.
I think so, too.
Let me ask, are you available for tomorrow? Because Senator Shield wants to ask more questions, and it appears that there are some other questions here today, and a couple of us have to go to another meeting at 3:00. Can we just continue this conversation on tomorrow?
Yes.
We'll be glad to return that.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there further questions before we adjourn for the afternoon? Any directions, Ms. Baker?
Just to note that we will continue on the self-sufficiency programs tomorrow. I don't know if we'll get into child welfare, but we'll go as far as we can and before we are on hiatus for next week.
Okay. Thank you very much, and the committee is adjourned.
Thank you.